Our dig at Sutton Hoo has come to an end.
Now the real work begins.
What will our discoveries this year reveal? Could there be clues on this edition of the Time Team podcast?
Welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek. Oh, what a 4 weeks it's been. We've come to the end of this amazing marathon that has been Sutton Hoo Season 2, the last season in our two-year work at Sutton Hoo to try to understand what is going on in Garden Field. It's been boiling hot and it's been freezing cold, but the main thing it's been is torrentially wet. Everybody's waterproof trousers have been out. Everybody has got used to bringing a change of socks. But when we arrived, it had been the driest spring forever. So we've seen all kinds of conditions. And it's been really good for the site because both the dry and the wet has let us see it drying and wetting and drying again in ways that are absolutely essential. So I think that we have seen Sutton Hoo at its best in these 4 weeks.
It's been so much fun. And I know, Helen, that you've been there pretty much every day. You know, you spend an awful lot of time on site. I've just sort of dropped in once a week. I thought I was doing very well weather-wise because the first few weeks, gorgeous sunshine, the last one, oh, did we get wet? We got a little bit damp. But no. I've seen how the sort of site has come on in dribs and drabs. You've been seeing it every single day. And now it's sort of done. And I think everybody, be it archaeologists, be it the people who are making the actual TV programs, everyone sort of breathed a bit of a sigh of relief. Poof, we've got to the end of it. And I thought that this episode of the Time Team podcast could be a really good opportunity to sort of debrief a little bit and look at some of the things that we've been trying to learn whilst on site and the sorts of things that we've been trying to gain from our time there a second time round. And we're going to do that with the help of a few people as well. So a little bit later on, you will meet a relation of Edith Pretty, this character from the 1930s who is of so much importance to Sutton Hoo and doing archaeology on the site. More on that in a little bit. And also one of our Sutton Hoo volunteers as well will be along, who, again, we couldn't have been doing the work that we've been doing at Sutton Hoo without. So we'll get to all that in a moment. But with the idea of this being a bit of a debrief, you said, Helen, that the real work begins. What happens next?
Yes, after the backfilling, what happens next? Well, all the records and all the finds and so on are taken back to the FAS offices, which are near York. And the work begins on trying to understand what we found. So all the plans are drawn and all the records are looked at and all the context descriptions are sorted out. All of the three-dimensional data is looked at. So a lot of our knowledge has actually come out of the plough soil. So finds are in three dimensions in the plough soil so that we can work out where concentrations of flint are, concentrations of pottery, and most importantly, to me, concentrations of little bits of metal, particularly the little droplets that can show where a cremation is or was. We've also got to do an immense amount on the bucket. You know, you think that it's been excavated. Well, what else is there to do on it? But we've got to get that. I mean, it's a bit like making a television programme. All that footage has got to be wrestled into something that the public can see and understand and that academics can see and understand. And I woke up in the middle of the night last night and I was just thinking of how we're going to draw it. Because just that one thing, it seems simple. You open a book or an article and you see a drawing. Yes, but half of this bucket is under a glass case and the other half is in twisted sections which can't really be handled very much. Who are we going to get to draw it? Are we going to have to find somebody who is as good with handling objects as they are with illustration? And we also want them to do quite a lot of the recording work, which normally somebody like me would do, but we don't want to handle it twice. So they've got to measure all the punch marks. They've got to spot everything. And simply that one task, how to draw the bucket. Oh, it was some hours of tossing and turning last night.
Okay, I think different things keep you up at night to the things that keep me up at night. Although I do have to say, I do have work-related dreams, but maybe we'll come to that. We'll park that, I think, for now, and maybe talk about that when we're not recording a podcast. But the great thing is, though, that there are so many experts who are part of Time Team who can be on standby to help, who we can bring in to do the analysis that we really need doing.
Yes, and one person we haven't heard from yet is Naomi Supal, Time Team's environmental archaeologist. She's been on site with her flotation tank. Naomi, how did it go with the flotation? Did you find much?
Oh, well, yeah, had some lovely soil samples from across all the trenches that were opened up. And yes, I can positively say I've had some good organics that have come out. Obviously, I can't say too much yet because there's analysis to be done. With flotation, you never know what you're going to get. You know, you've got your two objectives. You want to get some good environmental remains because that can answer many questions in different directions on a number of scales, from the localized to the more generalized. The joy of taking a soil sample is that you have such a good chance of getting much more of it to fit it back together. I've had it in the past where people have excavated things. There might have been a bead necklace. They might have got 5 beads. I put the soil sample in, and I find the other 32. You know, so that's a true number. That did happen to me once, and it was such a beautiful thing. I think in that instance, we did have pretty much the whole necklace.
We need to talk about quite a few things, don't we, from Sutton Hoo, and I'll get on to the things you've enjoyed, your favourite bits, in a moment. But first, I just wanted to bring to your attention a question that we had through on Patreon in our last episode. And Helen, when we were talking about this, didn't you, Helen, said, I think this is a question for Naomi to answer. So as we've got you here, we thought we'd put it to you. It comes from Anne Radmore, who says, from the seeds, etc., is it possible to tell what plants and flowers might have been blooming when one of the mounds was completed, so we can imagine it in full colour? So Naomi, would you have an idea at the moment what Sutton Hoo would have looked like from a flora and fauna perspective?
It depends where the sample's coming from. So with the Royal Burial Mounds, there would have been samples from inside, slightly outside the features. With trying to reconstruct things that were there, it's kind of a two-pronged approach. So yes, we can get seeds and things from the soil samples, but then also if samples have been taken for pollen analysis, you can get even more sort of finer detail, and the two eventually sort of marry up. So you can really get quite a species list going. Once you've got those species, you can look them up and see them in glorious technicolor and really start to get an idea of what was there. Certain species in and around Sutton Hoo that exists now would have been here back then. Their proportions might have changed over time. But for the most part, yeah, there are a lot of similarities of what we see today. There's been pollen analysis that's been done. I'm getting extra sort of macro remains from the soils. And then when you put all those things together, the more things you have, the tighter picture that you can see.
Naomi, this podcast is a bit of a debrief, really, looking back at some of the things that we've been doing at Sutton Hoo and what we enjoyed. So what have been your highlights of Sutton Hoo this year?
To be honest, one of the big highlights is actually just meeting people, people that absolutely love archaeology and also love Time Team as well. And to see the effect that it has on the people that are watching it, the joy that it brings, whether it's as a relaxation thing or, you know, they're learning about something at school or whatever it is. So that's always the biggest highlight. It's just a pure delight. Like the first time I ever came here, and you'll probably remember this, Helen, it was possibly about 15 years ago, and Victor had an exhibition on here, and we came down, and that's when I first met Angus, and you gave us a tour around the site, and we came to see Victor's exhibition, and Mick was there.
Yeah, that was really special, wasn't it?
And that was the last time I ever saw Mick. And obviously I didn't know that at the time, which was one of the reasons why I wanted to sort of give the little tribute on the tank to Mick, because I never thought, A, I'd get to visit it and have the tour that you gave us. It was just phenomenal. And I loved that fact. And then finding out that Time Team was coming back, and then it came back, and that, well, we could be really going to Sutton Hoo. This is crazy. And then we did. And then obviously all the things that happened last year with the Bromswell bucket, and all of that, it's going to take me a long time to fully let it all sink in. It's I'd say it's a once in a lifetime chance, but obviously it's a twice in a lifetime chance now.
It's now a twice in a lifetime chance. But it is, it just proves, doesn't it, that Sutton Hoo is so important to so many people, especially people who are part of Time Team for so many reasons. Naomi, we better let you go. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, guys. I'll see you soon.
Yep, see you soon. We've talked a bit about the 1930s excavations at Sutton Hoo, when Basil Brown was the first to discover the ships buried in the mounds. Now, he was commissioned by Mrs. Edith Pretty, and she owned and lived in Sutton Hoo House, which is now Tranmer House, so just to the north of the mounds. And she's become a bit of a legend of Sutton Hoo.
Yeah, she really has. And I'm delighted to say that one of her relatives is on the podcast now, Ollie Gerrish. How are you related to Edith Pretty then, Ollie? Just explain that first of all.
I believe I am her first cousin twice removed, somewhere like that. My great-grandmother, Mabel Dempster, was her first cousin. So Edith was born Edith Dempster. Edith, as you'll probably know, she didn't have children. She didn't have Robert until she was in her mid-late 40s. So for a long time, she didn't have children. And she spent a great deal of time with her first cousin, Mabel, and my grandmother and her sister and my great-uncle Stephen. So she was a godmother to my great-aunt. My grandmother and my great-aunt were her bridesmaids. She was my great-grandmother's bridesmaid. They were all very, very close indeed, and they travelled greatly together. And Edith was a huge part of coming to hunt balls and things with my great-grandparents. And she'd say, oh, God, the children stayed up till 5 a.m. And we had to, you know, sort of... She was a party animal too. And my mother once said to me, she said, oh... I said, Mummy, what's this place Sutton Hoo in this old album? She said, oh, that's Aunt Edith's house. She found some treasure. That's all she said.
It's a bit like that famous Daily Mail headline, Anglo-Saxon treasure goes to woman.
Yes, yes. Yeah, bizarre.
But that, it's so interesting to hear this, because we all know that Mrs. Pretty lived rattling around in that great big house with small son Robert. And it feels like, I mean, she was a very private and really quite enigmatic person. And you wonder what life must have been like in that house with so many bedrooms and just the two of them. But you telling us about the rest of the family makes you realise that, of course, there would have been people to stay, and there would have been parties, and there would have been visitors all the time. And us thinking of her as a kind of quiet, lonely woman, perhaps the way that she's shown in the dig, is perhaps not true.
Well, she was certainly a very sort of gay, vivacious person in her youth. You know, she hunted, she partied. She was one of two daughters of a very rich industrious. Edith's father happened to have just daughters, which is great. And I think it says a lot about him that he educated them as highly as any man could be. He taught them about charitable work, about looking after those who were less fortunate, about looking after people who worked for them, and took them travelling around the world and gave them a very good start in life. She would have bought Sutton Hoo House when she finally married. She bought it for just $15,000, which, I mean, at the time was a huge amount of money, but she bearing in mind she inherited $250,000, $15,000 really wasn't very much.
Well, we're very glad that she did have it, and she did want that work to be done on the mounds, because we probably wouldn't be here talking about it today if she hadn't. I know you've been really involved, Ollie, and really interested in the work that's been going on, what Time Team have been doing at Sutton Hoo. How does it feel for you as a relation of Edith Pretty to see all this work going on and all these discoveries being made at Sutton Hoo?
What it makes me feel is that actually, by being generous, which I think she was highly aware that she'd had many, many lucky privileges which very few people had. And she was deeply aware of that. And I think her discovery of it, the way then it was awarded as treasure trove, her backing of Basil Brown, her then later donation of it to giving it to the nation, which of course she never would have ever thought of it as hers anyway. I mean, that's just, I don't think, with the sort of person she was. I think it just shows how quietly, nowadays we all want to have our names in lights. I don't think she was interested in that at all. So I think she's quite an alien type of person to nowadays. She's a sort of anti-celebrity, the anti, you know, sort of, I think she must have been rather great. I mean, bloody good fun, but I'm very proud that someone like that was around, and also proud that some, you know, we share some of the same blood. I am proud of that. And it's wonderful to see, when you talk to archaeologists, just hearing how this person, really just from diligently and sort of deciding to do this thing with Basil Brown, has created so much pleasure and so much information and so much scholarship from what she regarded probably as a very small thing.
It's so lovely to hear you talk about her as just a member of the family, because we don't really know an awful lot about her. And that kind of enigmatic way in which she was portrayed in the film The Dig, that's the picture that we've all got of her. And to hear stories about her as a real living, breathing human being, it really rounds her out, makes you feel that, or makes me feel at any rate, that I've got a little more insight into her.
It is so, so fascinating. And Ollie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and shedding a little bit more light on this amazing woman with such a legacy at Sutton Hoo. It's really great to hear.
This is the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. Now, if you're itching to learn more about Sutton Hoo and to get further insight into what we've been up to there, then may I recommend you check out our Patreon. Our supporters get access to behind-the-scenes footage, exclusive videos and extended podcast interviews. Plus, you get that warm and fuzzy feeling that you're funding world-leading archaeology across the UK and around the world.
Yeah, and another thing that you can do as a Patreon supporter is get the chance to volunteer at one of our digs. And well, there were plenty of volunteers at Sutton Hoo in the test pits and the main trenches as well. Michelle Bailey was one of them. Great to speak to you, Michelle. Lovely to catch up again. How are you feeling now then, after it's all done and you've washed all the mud off?
it did take some effort to get the mud out, I will be honest.
And you were there during the rain, weren't you?
Yeah. There was a lot of sideways raining, but I'm still pretty much riding that wave. It has been such a great experience and I'm still on cloud nine. I can't stop talking about it. So it's been brilliant.
Brilliant. Why did you want to volunteer in the first place?
So I've been a fan of Time Team for about 20 years. I used to watch the back-to-back episodes on a Saturday morning while I was at university. But I think I realised too late that archaeology was an option that I could actually do as a career. I'd already by then had a degree in English and I was going into full-time employment. So the opportunity to volunteer was just like a dream come true, really. So I got to experience it when I thought it was something that I probably wouldn't ever actually get to do. So yeah, it's been amazing.
So what was your experience like? I mean, what did you have to do? And was it what you thought you would be doing when you signed up?
Yeah, I had the best day. So it was like a day in the life of an archaeologist. We turned up, I got to witness and experience the whole process. You got to see Justin doing the GPS and the digger. There was Emma and Alex with the metal detectors going around and they were talking to you. There was you and Matt presenting around me, people talking through the geophys. So we got to do it all, the GPS, the troweling, field walking, bag it and flag it if you found something. Yeah, I got the whole experience. It was brilliant.
And did you go into finds at all and do anything there? Because we did have volunteers there too.
When I visited and was just watching and wasn't a volunteer, I did go up to the finds house and got to watch the process, which was fascinating. Writing the numbers down and weighing all the finds that you had and everything, yeah.
I love the way that you describe it as a day in the life of an archaeologist. You really did get to do absolutely everything by the sounds of it, which is an amazing thing to be part of. What about the fact that you were actually at Sutton Hoo, which is such an important place for so many archaeologists, as we've been already discussing on the podcast today?
One of the great things about it, obviously, it has the history. You know, I'm not from far away, so I know the influence that it has and the links to other archaeology that's near where I live in Southend and the other Saxon burials. So I understand like its importance. But having Martin there as well and the people who, you know, this had been a part of their life since the 80s really brought how important it was. They were so willing to talk to you about anything, whether it was a volunteer, someone standing watching, or the experts on the field. Like everybody just wanted to talk to you about it and share their experience, which just made it even more magical, really.
Yeah, and I think one of the things about Martin Carver, is that he began as a volunteer as well. And he's come up from a non-standard route. You know, his degree's in maths and chemistry. So he knows what it's like. So he's always made the place very, very inclusive. And I've got a degree in archaeology, but I had to start volunteering as well before I went to university. That's how I got my place there. So lots of us have got that feeling that we know what it's like to start from the bottom, to not not quite know what you're doing, to have to watch, to have to be careful and ask questions and so on and so forth. So if we can help with people who are perhaps uncertain about what they want to do, we're quite welcoming, really.
Absolutely. And when you're speaking to the people, the enthusiasm that they have like seeps out of them, it radiates out of them, and they want to share that. So that talking with Martin, you just get that sense of how much it means to him and how much he wants other people to feel that excitement, and you do.
What's your advice then to somebody who's maybe just thinking about whether or not they want to sign up as a Patreon supporter?
Oh, do it. This is the great thing about the new format and Patreon, is because it offers so much more information and through different formats. Like, I never would have had this information if I hadn't have signed up for Patreon. I've watched Time Team for years, but like I say, it's always been something other people have done. I mean, it never felt that it was something that I could be part of. But now, going to Patreon and going to the dig, I got to meet other people. And by networking with those, I found out about free online courses that you can do for universities. There's short courses. You can join local groups at the Council of British Archaeology. They do summer excavations, volunteer research. So just by joining Patreon and then going to the dig, I've learned all of that stuff, which has been fantastic for me.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Michelle. We're so glad that you enjoyed it. And we'll hopefully see you at a site near you soon.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yes, it'd be lovely to see you again.
Lovely to see you again. Thank you.
Well, speaking of Patreon, I think it's time to go to a few questions. And these, as always, have come in from our wonderful Patreon supporters who, as you heard, have been getting their hands dirty at Certain Who, some of them anyway. But for those who don't necessarily get that opportunity, there are so many other ways that you can get involved with Time Team. You're funding the archaeology that we do, but also you can watch extended interviews. You can get some behind the scenes footage, additional videos, loads of exclusive stuff, and you get the opportunity to ask a question on this podcast. And this one's come in from Pamela Landridge, who says, I've been wondering lately about how, especially on a large project like Sutton Hoo, you determine who the boss is. Well, on this podcast, it's Helen. But what about Time Team in general? I imagine, says Pamela, there's many stakeholders. So who gets final say on things like how you're going to lift the bucket base? This is a brilliant question, and actually one that I've thought about quite a bit, because there are various different bosses as far as I could see when we were on site. There was Justin, who was in charge of Trench 1 and Trench 2, who would be making sure that you were standing in the right place at the right time and who was coordinating who digs where and when. But what about the sort of overarching control of where is dug, how it's dug, what questions we're seeking to answer?
It's a very good question, and I wonder if we ought to broaden it out for another podcast and talk about what you could call archaeological procurement. It's how you get archaeology done on the kind of big logistical side. And it is very different on something like this Sutton Hoo project, because there are so many people who are, as you say, Pamela, stakeholders, but who aren't the usual kind. So normally, I mean, always on an archaeological excavation, there's a landowner. And that landowner is often not that interested in what happens. Often they're being forced to have an archaeological excavation because they want to build a housing estate or something. But here the landowner is the National Trust, who's tremendously interested because, after all, they're a heritage organisation. And so they've got particular desires about wanting to produce an experience for their visitors and for their volunteers and so on, and also to create something that will be interesting and useful for years to come, not just for visitors, but also for managing the land, because they've got to keep it in good heart for everyone forever, as their slogan has it. So first of all, we've got Angus, who's the representative, the archaeological representative of the landowners, the National Trust. Then we've also got a second lot of National Trust people who are the property people. So they run Sutton Hoo specifically, not archaeology, but every bit of Sutton Hoo. Then we have the research community. So that's people like Martin and Catherine Hills, who came to visit to look at the pottery, and me, and also the British Museum, who Mrs. Pretty, back in the 1930s, put a covenant on the land so that at the Mound Cemetery, the British Museum have rights over research and fieldwork there, not the rest of the estate. So we don't theoretically have to involve the British Museum at Gardenfield, but it's polite and sensible to do so. Also, we had Chris Fern visiting, who wrote up the excavation under the visitor centre and the exhibition hall. So he's another stakeholder. We try to work through consensus with all these people. So Justin is the, in a way, he's the archaeological contractor. So he designs the project, but he designs it with a brief and in conjunction with all the other stakeholders. So he writes something, he sends it off, we all look at it. Angus particularly has said how much he's prepared to, how much archaeology he's prepared to, in inverted commas, sacrifice or interrogate. You know, you can only do it once. How much archaeology is he prepared to lose to understand the broader history of the whole of Gardenfield and the whole estate? Now, have I forgotten anybody? Well, of course, yes. And then the other thing is Time Team and the Patreons, because there's always a funder. Each individual Patreon perhaps doesn't get much of a say, but as a group, their wishes are interpreted, if you like, by Time Team. We've always got an eye as to what the Patreons would like to see, what they would like to experience if they visit, and how we can use volunteers. And the good thing is that the way that we do fieldwork at Sutton Hoo, going down through the plough soil very, very carefully so as not to miss anything, is ideal for lots of relatively unskilled labour. You only need to be able to do one thing really well, and that's produce a very tidy, clean surface. If you can recognise finds and know that they're different from stones and sand, that's absolutely a bonus. But those are two quite easy things. You don't need to be able to disentangle many soil layers, and you don't need to be able to record, photograph, survey, etc., etc. Now, I see, though, Pamela, that you've got a final bit to your question. Who gets the final say on things like how you're going to lift the bucket base? Well, that brings in one last thing, which is that it's going to be written up by Justin and Martin, because Martin and Madeline were the people who put the research plan together back in 2014 that we're beginning to, we've tackled one aspect of the research plan, and everything has to have an eye on the final publication. So with lifting the bucket base, I know one of the things that was absolutely top of Justin's mind was that he really wanted to make sure that if it was in at all possible, he'd seen the grave cut of that, so that he wasn't smashing through it while he was making the hole that you needed to get around the block to lift it. That was one of the reasons that it took so long. And I think that possibly wasn't... I'm not sure that Justin ever actually admitted to this on camera, so that's why that wasn't very obvious in the programme. But he kept saying, if I must mess this up and I have to admit it in print, well, I really don't want to. So he and Cecily, who was also part of FAS, it was their final decision as to how long that took. Nobody could hurry them up because their necks were on the line, so to speak, and they did it supremely well, but nobody else could tell them what to do. And it's all a mixture of consensus and knowing that some people have to carry the can for different things. And if one person is carrying a can in public, then we have to let them make their decisions and not micromanage them. So I hope that gives some kind of indication.
Yeah, it does.
And hope Justin isn't going to mind me saying that he was worried about
I'm sure.
Because he wasn't very publicly worried.
I'm sure he won't. Pamela, yeah, that was a brilliant question. And I hope we've given you an answer there, which I think was perhaps a little bit more complicated than, well, either of us, me or you, Pamela, were expecting. Let's move on to the final question. And it comes from Martin Young. Martin is basically prolific on Patreon. I'm always seeing him commenting on everything that we're doing. And I think, Martin, you did get to come along to Sutton Hoo as well. And Helen, I believe you've had a chat with Martin in person. I sadly wasn't there
on
that day. Yeah, you have.
Yes. Yeah. I've just recognised his name because we had a discussion about how many Martins there were.
Yeah, and too many, as far as I'm concerned.
You were Martin W and he was Martin Y. Yeah. Yes.
So Martin says, why were mounds 1 and 2 that contain the ship burials circular? A rectangular mound, says Martin, would have been more fitting to contain their entirety, much like the size of a Bronze Age long barrow. So do we know why they opted for a circle?
Well, nobody has left any hint of their thinking in writing to give us an idea. There's nothing that I know of in poetry, although the place you'd have to go through is Beowulf to see if I'm right about that. There's nothing very obvious that I can think of. But the next thing to say is that common sense, like a rectangular mound would have fitted a ship better, common sense is always... it's never a very good guide to the past. It's not a very good guide to the present. We can all think of things that would be absolutely common sense that nobody does. And yes, a long barrow. Oh, by the way, long barrows in Neolithic, not Bronze Age. So yes, a long barrow would have worked much better. But what you have to remember is that hardly any Anglo-Saxon mounds contain ships or even boats. You can count them on the fingers of one hand. Most of them seem to be harking back to Bronze Age round barrows, and the idea is something like, if you are perhaps a new people setting up new kingdoms after the Roman Empire, you might feel slightly fragile and slightly like your claim isn't as solid as it could possibly be. If you build something that looks like an old round barrow on a piece of land, then that's a big statement to say, look, our ancestors are here, and therefore we legitimately are here. An awful lot, I was going to say most, but an awful lot of Anglo-Saxon literature is all justifying why the Anglo-Saxons ought to rule Britain. You know, the whole of Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People is explaining why it's okay to come and take over this country. And that's literature, history, but it can also be done through archaeology, through building a material thing. We might do it today by, say, going... colonialism of the 19th century might have consisted of going and building something like New Delhi, an enormous colonial capital that puts a kind of material footprint on the ground. And I don't think it's any coincidence that most barrows in Britain are round barrows, and the Anglo-Saxons are just taking the standard way of marking a burial in the landscape, which is the round barrow, and using it. Now, the last thing I'll say about this, back to common sense not being a good guide to the past. If you try to work out what was going on in Mound 2, you come to the almost inescapable idea, because once you've looked at the fact that there's a chamber grave, like Prittlewell, it's kind of cubic, a chamber under the ground, and there definitely isn't a ship below that, but there was a ship in Mound 2 because it's full of iron rivets. So you've got to do something with your ship that puts it on top of the burial chamber, and you can either turn it upside down, but even so, it would probably have been too long for the mound, or, glory of glories, you could put it the right way up. So you've got the rising stem and stern of the boat with the round mound in the middle, and the stem and the stern of the boat would have stuck out like the horns of cow pie. Wouldn't that be a sight to see?
That would have looked amazing. Yeah, really, and sort of enigmatic, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and nothing to do with common sense.
No. Who needs that? Who needs that? Martin, a brilliant question. Thank you so much. If you want to ask yours on a future episode, patreon.com/timeteamofficial is where you need to go.
Next week, it's back to business as usual. Martin, you're finding out a bit more about mudlarking, I believe?
Yeah, on the Thames in London, which will be really, really exciting. We'll be bringing you that. And Danny Wootton is also back with more Time Team news.
So do join us again on another Time Team podcast. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.